Perhaps the single most moving account of that night in May of 1897 comes to us by way of an anonymous letter from one of the orchestra musicians received by Mahler the day after the performance. I quote that letter in part. 12th of May, 1897, Your Excellency, most esteemed Herr Kapellmeister. The following lines are written by one who has good reason to remain nameless, for otherwise I cannot speak freely and therefore resort to writing anonymously. I hope that you will forgive me for doing so, since the only purpose of this letter is to tell you with what joy and enthusiasm your conducting of Lohengrin yesterday filled not only this old musician and even older Wagnerian, but everyone who is an artist at all in the true Wagnerian sense. For a good 21 or 22 years, this writer has not heard the work played as it was yesterday under your baton. Your tempi, your nuances and accentuation, all these were Wagnerian in the fullest sense of the word. The master himself conducted in this way. That is how it used to be played under his baton. No more, alas. Your conducting is truly Wagnerian, for you know how to modify the tempo with perfect fidelity to the master's intentions. No detail is lost, yet nothing is out of proportion within the framework of the whole. Since Wagner and Hans von Bülow, I have never experienced conducting of such significance as yours. Accept my most heartfelt gratitude and my best wishes and blessings on your future. With great respect, an old musician, unquote. Well, I would call all of this a good start, wouldn't you? Now, Mahler's responsibilities at the Vienna Opera, particularly after he assumed the position of music director on October 8th of 1897, left him no time to compose, a point of signal frustration for him. He was busy, and not just with conducting. For example, the reforms he instituted at the opera were as uncompromising as his own conducting style. For example, he abolished the practice of claques, by which singers would buy up tickets and install ready-made cheering sections in the audience, whose job it was to applaud their benefactor and disrupt the other singers. Abolish my clack! Oh, my friends, the singers howled. He abolished the practice of allowing latecomers into a performance once it had begun, no matter how rich, aristocratic, or influential they were. Oh, how the fat cats howled. Objections to that innovation got to the ears of the emperor himself, who stood behind Mahler 100%. Mahler also did away with the distribution of complimentary tickets, insisting that the critics, of which there were many in Vienna, buy their own tickets like everybody else. Howl, howl, howl. Don't you just love it? Mahler rankled everyone, the aristocrats, the critics, the singers, but he delivered, and he quickly made the Vienna Opera and the Vienna Opera Orchestra, known as the Vienna Philharmonic during the off-season, the best performing institutions in the Western world, no exceptions. Despite the difficulties he encountered, and we'll talk about them in Lecture 7, Mahler's first few years in Vienna were phenomenally successful. For a time, he conducted both the opera and the Vienna Philharmonic concerts. The audiences adored him. He became a genuine celebrity and something of a legend in his own time. It was this celebrity, this legend in his own time, that Alma Schindler met in November of 1901. So back to Alma and Gustav and some personal information. We read constantly of Alma's beauty. Well, to be honest, her photos do not reveal a great beauty, at least not by modern standards. She was tall, handsome, somewhat zaftig, Rubenesque, Junoesque, if you prefer, the ideal late Victorian female form. Certainly much of her beauty was in her personality and her eyes, about which everyone, friend or foe, commented. Alma's third and last husband, Franz Werfel, called her, quote, one of the very few great sorceresses of our time, unquote.